Hello, I'm Samantha Sear, and this is the Rooted by Nature podcast. I'm an artist and stay-at-home mum, and in this podcast, I'll be talking about how I connect with nature and the changing seasons, share recipes and creative ideas. I'll take you along on my journey as I learn about the trees, plants and wildlife around me, and the folklore, magic and mythology surrounding them. It's my hope that this uplifting podcast may encourage you to slow down, enjoy the little things, notice the beauty outside your front door, and feel more rooted by nature. In this episode, I'll be talking about late winter, why the ancient magical owl is my favourite nocturnal creature, seasonal affective disorder, and my personal toolkit for beating the winter blues. I'll be reflecting on New Year expectations and sharing my favourite banana muffin recipe. Late winter is not a season I typically enjoy. In fact, I used to dread it coming. The Christmas sparkle would have worn off, the anticlimactic New Year passed, and there I was, hunkered down in January, feeling positively blue and grey and beige. But this year, I am feeling more pink and orange with maybe a gold glitter sparkle around the edges. Yes, I am a bit mad, and I tend to see and feel things in colours, but trust me when I say that pink and orange is where I want to be. So let's backtrack a bit and I will start making a bit more sense. My buoyantly good mood started when I reframed the whole late winter season in my mind. From nature's perspective, this cold grey time of year is just as important as our verdantly green spring and summer. Because without this time of hibernation, rest and renewal, nothing would have the energy to wake up or sprout come spring. If it makes you feel a little less envious of the hibernating wildlife, then maybe it would be surprising to hear that only hedgehogs, dormice and bats truly hibernate through winter. Others enter a state of inactivity. They hide away for a day or so at a time to conserve energy. And that sounds like a good idea to me. The bare trees, barren landscape, dried out seed heads and decaying flora are not dead. They're just asleep. We're only seeing the surface. The importance lies in the roots. Under the soil, millions of delicate lace-like roots are soaking up all this rain, reaching deep into the warm earth and hiding from the frosts until the spring sunshine returns, and they can send up fresh green shoots. Leaves can unfurl from buds and colour will return to the landscape once more. If you look close enough, you'll see buds are already there on the branches, encased in a tough shell to protect them from the frost and snow. Oak, ash, maple and elder will all have buds on them by now. And if you can see catkins hanging like fluffy green lamb's tails, then you've found a hazel tree. Yesterday I was surprised and enchanted by the sight of a tree covered in a froth of pale pink blossom. I didn't realise there were trees that blossom this early, and as silly as it sounds, these tiny flowers felt like they were there just for me, a sign that it would be a good day. I was, at the time, hopelessly lost. I'd taken a wrong turn and ended up in what I think was a farm. But the blossom really lifted my spirits and I was soon back on the road and arrived on time to meet my friend for lunch. Spring is on its way back to us and the signs are out there if we choose to look for them. Where I won't find them are inside my own home and my own head, which is why I get out as much as I can. Plus, having a toddler does get me off the couch, because when I look out and see rain and lousy weather, he looks out and sees puddles. And I would recommend jumping in puddles with free abandon. Yes, I'm an adult. Yes, it is still just as satisfying. Plus, it's easy to feel a little off kilter when we're turning the lights on during the day due to so little sunlight. And just this little thing can affect our bodies and our minds. Our circadian rhythm is like an inner clock that tells us when it's time to be up and about and when it's time to be in bed. And not only does it influence our sleep-wake patterns, but our digestive system and other bodily functions too. The more daylight we can get, the better we can keep this clock on track. And it's important because it's this natural rhythm that controls the production of our sleep hormone, melatonin. So the more natural daylight we can squeeze into our day, the easier we'll find it to wind down in the evening. Not to mention that fresh air is good for our respiratory systems and our skin, both of which can be affected when we put the heating on our home. If I've had the heating on a lot, I also like to use diffusers to compensate for the lack of moisture in the air. It's now quite easy and inexpensive to find them, and they're essentially little bowls of water encased in a pretty lamp-like shell that glows all different colours and shoots a stream of water particles into the air. It's also a lovely way to use essential oils and make my home smell wonderful at the same time. You can also get diffusers that plug into your laptop via a USB cable, so you can have one sitting next to you while you work. And these USB ones mean that you can hook them up to an external battery pack if access to a plug socket is a bit tricky. Another gadget that doubles as a lamp is a natural light alarm clock. And the idea is that instead of waking up with a jump to a jarring sound, this clock slowly illuminates, replicating the light from the rising sun and waking us gently, telling our inner body clock that it's time to get up. It's also nice to wake up to a softly lit room instead of the dark. And if you do have to wake up before sunrise, which in January can be past 8 o'clock, the upside is you can watch the sun come up, which I like to do over my morning coffee. Another way to compensate for the lack of sunshine is a vitamin D supplement, which I take daily after being told that I was severely deficient. And I take this through autumn and winter, as well as liquid iron to fight fatigue. But it's worth noting that caffeine can block the absorption of iron and vitamin C promotes it. So it's worth taking any daily supplements after breakfast, maybe with a glass of orange juice rather than your morning coffee. I know I'm not alone when it comes to missing the summer sunshine. And when the days are grey and the nights come early, this month can feel monotonous and never-ending. So I like to focus my curiosity on the night. If all this darkness is here to stay for the time being, then why not find some magic in it? After all, our folklore, stories and myths all tell us that there's magic to be found in the nighttime. The witching hour falls at midnight, a gateway between night and day, and nocturnal creatures have about them a feeling of otherworldliness. The owl is the first creature that comes to my mind, and I've always felt a kinship with this beautiful bird of prey. Perhaps it's because they are the most human-looking of birds. Instead of their eyes being positioned on either side of their head, they're forward-facing like ours, on a round, flat face, positioned just above their nose-like beak, and some look like they even have eyebrows. We have 5 owls native to Britain: the British barn owl, short-eared, long-eared, tawny, and the little owl. Maybe the most obvious reason for their links to magic would be the very inhuman ability to rotate their heads by 270 degrees. 14 vertebrae in their necks, double what we have, give them this flexibility, and they can tilt up and down by 90 degrees too. Perhaps some of the mystery comes from their silent flight. They can glide as slowly as 2 miles an hour, and their velvety soft feathers and comb-like arrangement mean that they stream airflow, so if you were lucky enough to spot one, you'd have no warning. The face and belly of a barn owl is so white it's almost phosphorescent, a ghostly spectre in the night. It's thought that the reason for this is to camouflage the owl, so its prey looking upward wouldn't see a black silhouette descending, but a mixture of white moonlight and cloud. Also, the ghostly image is probably strengthened by the hissing and screeching sounds a barn owl makes, a howling in the night, not the gentle tu-it-tu-woo of the tawny owl. Owls don't sing like the birds that wake us at dawn and wish farewell to the day in song as dusk descends. And maybe this lack of song and the way songbirds attack owls if they dare to have the audacity to fly by day, connect them in our minds with a bad omen. In many cultures across the world, from Britain to Greece, from China to Native America, owls were harbingers of death. One of the Welsh names for an owl is literally corpse bird, and some believe they were psychopomps. Sorry, I had to get that word in there somewhere. What a great word. It's Greek and translates as soul conductor. It is an old belief that owls escort the dead to the afterlife. Some Native American tribes would place an owl feather in the hand of the deceased to aid their journey. And during the Shang Dynasty in China, owl figures were placed in graves. All of this sounds rather negative and a little bit morbid, but the ancient Greeks have a much more positive association with little owls in particular. as they're sacred to Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom, patron goddess to the city of Athens. Now, whether you associate the owl with death and bad omens, or wisdom, knowledge, and foresight, us humans have had a connection to owls for millennia. We know the owl is ancient. This creature is over a million years old. And our spiritual connection to it goes back at least as far as the Paleolithic period. We know this because an owl carving on a cave wall in France is 30,000 years old. If you'd like to delve a little deeper into owl mythology and learn more about them in general, I'd recommend a little book I'm reading this month called The Secret Life of the Owl by John Lewis Stemple. It's a light, easy read, and the cover is beautiful and makes me want to pick up a pencil and start sketching owls. Now, I know that not everybody would have a book about owls on their bookshelf, and one of the reasons why I like reading about wildlife is that it helps me feel more connected with the natural world, especially in winter when there's more of a disconnect. It's important because I found this feeling of belonging to be an effective weapon in fighting off a seasonal affective disorder, aptly abbreviated to the acronym of SAD. Seasonal affective disorder is a kind of depression brought on by winter. Lethargy, low mood, lack of interest, isolation, and a sense of hopelessness are all common symptoms. And like most forms of depression and anxiety, it can be a little different for everyone and affect some people a little and others a lot. But I think just being aware that it affects me has really helped me combat it and protect myself. It took me years to realise that my episodes of anxiety and depression correlated with the colder months. It wasn't the only trigger, but it was a consistent factor. At a time when depression began to seriously affect my life and I began to take my mental health much more seriously, I'd never heard of seasonal affective disorder. And it's funny how simply knowing that others experience the same thing and having a name for it validated my feelings and made them a little less scary, and it also enabled me to feel a little more prepared. If this is something you'd like more information on, the mental health charity Mind have a great website, and if you're seeking advice to treat depression, please speak to a medical professional. Personally, I found it helpful to arm myself with a toolkit to help keep the symptoms at bay. And the following may all sound a little obvious, and to be honest, it is, but it's easier said than done, and the discipline is where I'm usually lacking. So I focus my energy on the trying, because I found prevention for me is better than cure. The basis for my toolkit is nothing new: nutritious food, lots of water, sleep, movement, connection, and time for creativity. I've begun shifting the focus on friends away from December and into January and February, because trying to see everyone before Christmas is stressful, and it's actually the beginning of the year when I really need that sense of connection and emotional support. Plus, I have the time to focus on them instead of the festive rush. I also try to be much more aware of what I am feeding my brain as well as my body. If I'm feeling low or off balance, I'll avoid binge watching emotional dramas, sad films, serious fiction, doom scrolling, and even charity adverts that are designed to pull at my heartstrings. There are some wonderful YouTube videos out there for movement. For many, it's a workout, but for me, I like something relaxed and slow, like Tai Chi and yoga. The benefit of having all of this online content is the incredible choice and the opportunity to discover new ways to help us relax. A friend of mine is really into ASMR, which, if you haven't heard of it, like me, who thought it was bonkers when she explained it to me, is effectively a broad range of sound effects created to help you find something that triggers a response in you, the aim being to relax. While I'm on the topic of YouTube, a channel that I would recommend is called Pickup Limes. Not pickup limes like in a bar, but the citrus fruit, Pickup Limes. It's a vegan cooking channel, and the woman that hosts it is very engaging, and she's good at delivering easy to remember sound bites when it comes to learning which foods are good for us and when, and her standalone videos on digestion and gut health have been really helpful. The Pick Up Limes website is also great, not just for the recipes, but the articles which cover everything from food to general well-being. And after learning a bit more about how food and my gut affects my mind and moods, I've started adding little things to my diet, just here and there, which have been surprisingly easy to do. I've swapped toast for porridge, the oats help sustain my energy levels through the morning, and I add chia seeds to the oats before cooking them to bump up my omega-3 intake, which is associated with improved cognition and mood. Chia seeds are absolutely tiny and they're tasteless, so I'll also add some to my water glass during the day as they provide fibre too. Over the top of my porridge, I sprinkle sunflower seeds and a couple of chopped Brazil nuts, which provide selenium, a mineral that helps fight damage within the brain and reduces negative moods and depressive symptoms. I also add pumpkin seeds, because these are a good source of iron and protein, and they also contain an amino acid called tryptophan, which helps us produce melatonin, the hormone that helps us sleep. Obviously, there is so much more when it comes to diet, but I find a complete overhaul too overwhelming to contemplate. And I personally have a lot of allergies, and that complicates things for me. So these tiny additions to just one meal is only a little, but over time, I think it'll help a lot. Oh, and while I'm on the subject, it's always worth researching before adding anything to your diet, and you really can have too much of a good thing. For instance, 3 is the maximum number of Brazil nuts to eat in a day, or you risk giving yourself selenium poisoning. And if you are considering making any major changes to your diet and you're thinking of speaking to someone, it's worth noting that there is a big difference between a nutritionist and a qualified dietitian. On days where I'm feeling a little low and I need it, I'll turn to Bach's flower remedies and I'll take a few drops on my tongue to tackle a particular mood swing. I use tinctures which contain alcohol, but there are alcohol-free remedies available. Not that I am just knocking back flower-flavoured brandy. The brandy is there to extend the shelf life. It's not really part of the remedy. It's the flowers you want to focus on. But yes, there are alcohol-free versions available. Personally, I use elm for exhaustion and overwhelm, honeysuckle to help ground me and focus on the present, aspen for getting fear and worry under control, oak for help when I have been pushing way past my limits, and white chestnut for reining in those spiralling thoughts and repetitive thought patterns. There is a lot of research and information available about why herbal remedies work and how they affect us on a physical and a mental level. And they really do work. But to be honest with you, even if I'm not thinking about all those reasons why they work, sometimes the placebo effect is just as efficient. If my head is in a spin and I think that this is going to calm me down, my mindset alters and I automatically start to calm down. So, on the topic of mindset, I know that there is a lot of enthusiasm for the law of attraction, vision boards, and manifestation, especially around the New Year period. And as much as this interests me, and I know that there is a lot of research behind it as to why it works, it's not something I have yet embraced and spent time on. And if I'm being honest, the idea of knowing exactly what it is I want and striving for a big dream can seem just a little daunting and overwhelming. But something similar that does put me in the same positive mindset and takes very little time to do each season is a mood board. I hung a cork board in my bedroom for this purpose. And as I have a love for magazines, especially those filled with beautiful photographs, I have lots of feel-good images laying around that made sense to snip up and put together somewhere that I would see it on a daily basis. The point of this originally was to help me enjoy each season instead of hiding from it. So this month it will be something warm and cozy with frosty snowy landscapes, mugs of tea and probably knitting. Although as much as I say it's not a vision board, my summer one did in fact all come true, as the photos I was drawn to were things that I'd love to have, such as an egg chair, a herb garden, go on picnics with friends, a day at the seaside, and creative projects to commit to. I think sometimes just having a prompt to keep something at the forefront of my mind naturally motivates me to just keep leaning towards it, a bit like moving chess pieces around with a clear idea of what I want to transpire a few moves later. that's kind of how the summer board happened, I think. I used to buy a lot of magazines, but as the cost of living has gone up dramatically and magazines are not cheap, I have been reining in my magazine shopping. But the one subscription that did survive the cull was the Simple Things magazine, which comes out once a month and each issue is specific to that month. Out in nature, creative hobbies, things to see. You get the idea. It's also not surprising that it's up my street, really. Another idea that's not part of my toolkit, but does help me chip away at the January blues, is that January and February don't really exist. Or at least they didn't exist. In a Roman calendar, which only had 10 months, which sounds good to me, because I could happily skip straight to March. And if you follow the old Julian calendar, then you may be celebrating Christmas in January and still be enjoying all the festivities. I could go into a lengthy explanation of all of this, but I'm not going to, because if you've heard my earlier episodes, then you might start to think I have some bizarre obsession with calendars. Although, humour me here, I cannot resist going off on a total tangent about days of the week. Have you ever spent time thinking about why we have 7 days and what the names mean? The names are made up of gods, goddesses, and our solar system, which I think is marvellous. But it's not obvious because over the years the names have been shortened or pronunciation has altered. Monday was Moon Day, and the moon, by the way, is often a goddess, like Luna to the Romans and Selene to the ancient Greeks. Tuesday belongs to Tu, which was the Anglo-Saxon name for the Norse god of war, son of Odin. Odin was the Allfather and god of wisdom, pronounced Woden by the Anglo-Saxons, and so Woden's day became Wednesday. Thor's day is Thursday. Friday is now missing a G, as it was Frigg Day, Frigg being Odin's wife, goddess of motherhood. Saturday has lost the N, as it was Saturn Day, and of course we have Sunday. If you're wondering where the missing planets come in, Chu to the Greeks was Mars, to the Romans, Odin was Mercury, Frigg was Venus, and Thor, god of thunder, was linked to Zeus, who was associated with Jupiter. So, from Monday to Sunday, we have Moon Day, Tuesday, Woden's Day, Thor's Day, Frigg Day, Saturn Day, and Sunday. I totally geek out about stuff like this. It's just the kind of thing that bounces around my head while I'm sitting there with a blank new calendar trying to fill out my dates. And January, okay, I'm going to do it again. January, by the way, is named after the Roman Janus, god of new beginnings, transitions, gateways, passage of time and duality. A god with two faces, one looking back to the past and the other forward to the future. This is so befitting that I find it rather satisfying, but I promise I am going to stop here and probably seek help for my bizarre calendar obsession. My original point was that the idea of January and February not existing reinforced the fact in my mind that our months of the year are all man-made. The whole concept of a 24-hour day, 7-day week and 12-month calendar year is just an idea created by humans. From nature's perspective, the year does not begin on January the 1st. The seasons are cyclical by nature. There is no beginning and no end, just a natural rhythm and a balance. A fascinating and mind-bogglingly perfect design that gives and takes at exactly the right time, so that everything can thrive. The January New Year and all the big expectations that come with that has no place in nature, and I've decided this year has no big place in my life either. Over the years, the media message of New Year, New You just hasn't changed in the sense that it's still directed at us from someone wanting to make a profit. Create a sense of lack and need and you can sell a product. It's simple business sense. But I do think it has evolved, and personally I find it can be harder to tune it out because it's become much more subtle. New Year self-improvement has gone from weight loss plans and gym memberships to self-help, good mental health, what to eat, manifesting and learning. And as much as I think all of this well-being content is a good thing in moderation, an overdose of this blanket messaging for self-improvement can be just as damaging if the end result is an overwhelming feeling of just not being good enough. And that can take on many guises, whether that's not slim enough, smart enough, healthy enough. This, of course, is different for everyone, depending on your circumstances. For me, an example of a content overdose would result in me feeling totally inept because I don't eat a plant-based diet, I can't afford to only buy organic, I don't look like a model, I haven't replaced everything I use in my home with a natural product, I don't have a YouTube-worthy morning routine or practice yoga daily, I'm not multilingual, I'm not a perfect mum, and I'm not a social influencer or a CEO, and I'm not 100% happy 100% of the time. Now, what you absorb from the January onslaught is very much dependent on where your feelings lie. But I don't think I'm alone in getting an impression of personal lack instead of a feeling of empowerment. This is why I put down my phone and step outside. And remember, just for a while, what the real world feels like. It can be so easy to get sucked in by all the incredible content available to us that's so easily accessed on multiple devices and always at our fingertips. Don't get me wrong, I feel blessed to be born into a part of the world, a society, a generation that has access to such an abundance of information, guidance, and creative ideas. But I also think it's a double-edged sword, and the downside to having such a broad and detailed view of what so many other people are doing brings with it a natural inclination for comparison. And if you're comparing yourself to not one person, but 100 people that have popped into your view on TV, film, social media, magazines, websites, blogs, YouTube videos, adverts, podcasts, it is impossible to feel like you're doing enough. So if I'm feeling driven and I've not completely overloaded on it all, then I'll just pick one thing, no more than that, and just a little achievable thing, and I'll focus on that. Something that will deliver quickly and have an enjoyable result. For me, it was learning how to knit. Nothing fancy, just a simple scarf, and I watched a YouTube tutorial, and the satisfaction of wrapping up my toddler in his new little scarf as we headed into the cold was simply wonderful. Equally important to my mental health at this time of year is tuning out the news. Yes, I know how that sounds, and yes, it is important not to live in a bubble and to be aware of current affairs, but it's equally important to retain a sense of balance, and I find that too much bad news can start to warp my perception of reality. It's hard to continually remind myself that I'm not seeing good news because good news just doesn't make money. It doesn't mean that there's not as much good news out there in the world. Bad news makes headlines, sells papers, keeps people watching, stops them reaching for the remote. The urgency of the language is deliberate clickbait to keep you on a website and encourage doom scrolling. Now, I'm sure that many of you listening are much better at tuning this out than I am. But if I engage, I start to endlessly worry. It's difficult to find joy in the little things if I'm thinking about people dying in war-torn countries and drowning in flash floods and freezing on the streets and children starving and the threat of nuclear war and the climate crisis and animals facing extinction. The list is endless. And it's not just the news, but the adverts as well. All charities asking for money, which I know is a good cause, but it still starts to bend reality until I'm left feeling like the world is ending. Yes, that sounds dramatic, but it's not a conscious thought. It's a subconscious absorption of everything around me. And because it's on every screen and it's subtle, I don't notice or realise why my mood is off, why everything has shifted a little bit, why I've lost interest in hobbies, why the colour is draining out of life in general. So as a rule, when I know that I'm likely to be coming down off the Christmas high, I limit my screen time. I mute adverts, I turn off the news, I avoid the papers, and I opt for more feel-good TV. Yes, I know this sounds like avoidance, and it is, but it's just temporary. During a time that I know I'm vulnerable, to feeling down, and anything evocative can play havoc with my emotions. There is a sense of empowerment I find by taking control of my environment like this. I don't have to feel bombarded by information. I do have the power to switch off. A lovely antidote to an overdose of bad news is a little publication called The Happy Newspaper, produced by Emily Croxhead. It's a colourful newspaper full of exclusively good news. When I used to work in an office, I had a subscription to this, and as just a little act of rebellion, would leave it in the kitchen for my colleagues to find. Photograph articles and WhatsApp them to friends, and once I've read it, I'd pop it in the post to someone that I knew would enjoy it. You'd really be surprised at how much good news is out there. We just don't often seek it out. And for me, this complete imbalance of exposure to good and bad news can start to just warp my sense of reality sometimes, and the world can seem like a very dark place. If I do start to slip down that rabbit hole, I stress bake. The apron comes out, and I don't care how much I make or who eats it, I just need to get baking. But in January, after so much indulgence in December, my go-to recipe is actually for healthy breakfast muffins. The recipe originally came from Delicious magazine, but I think I've changed it so much over time that it wouldn't be recognisable. And I love that about this recipe. It becomes whatever I need to use up in the cupboards. I call this healthy because the fat content comes from yogurt and coconut oil instead of butter. And the honey replaces refined sugar, or I'll use maple syrup if I have it. In a pinch, I'll just use plain flour. But if I have it on the shelf, I'll use spelt flour as well. It adds fibre and it's great for flavour. I use any fruit that I have to hand, which is usually brown bananas, but I've added a little fruit puree to that too when my toddler hasn't finished them, like apple and pear. If they're just for me, then I'll add lots of spice, chopped pecan nuts and seeds. Dried fruit varies from raisins to cranberries to dates. And if my husband wants some muffins, then I will just pair it right back to just bananas and raisins and chocolate chips, which is his favourite. So here is the basic recipe, and I hope that you enjoy whichever variation you like. Start with two separate bowls, one for wet ingredients and one for dry. Preheat the oven to 180 degrees fan and begin by melting 100 millilitres of coconut oil and honey together so that this has time to cool down, because you don't want scrambled eggs if you add your beaten eggs to hot oil. I use 1 to 2 tablespoons of honey. The more you use, the sweeter the muffins. So a lot of the time this will just depend on my mood and my stress level. So just add however much suits your taste. So the wet ingredients are the coconut oil and honey, 4 mashed bananas. The browner or blacker the bananas, the better, because then that flavour will really come through in the finished product. When you've got a yellowish banana, it's harder to mash. You end up with lumps and you just completely lose the flavour. So if you've got manky bananas, don't throw them away. Throw them into this recipe. And because I have a toddler, I have always got a bowl full of bananas that are on the turn. So anyway, back to the recipe. Sorry, I went off on another tangent. So 100 grams of full fat natural yogurt and 2 large beaten eggs. As always, you will find this recipe, the condensed version, in the show notes for easy reference. For the dry ingredients, weigh out 150 grams of plain flour and 50 grams of spelt flour. Or just 200 grams of plain flour if you don't have the spelt. 50 grams of porridge oats, 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, and 1.5 teaspoons of bicarbonate of soda, 1/4 teaspoon of salt and ground cinnamon, nutmeg and cardamom. The amount you use is down to you. This sounds obvious, but smell the mixture when you put the spices in. If you can't smell the spices, then you won't taste them, so add more. Equally, if the smell is overpowering, then you've probably overdone it. I have a muffin tin, as I found the cupcake tins weren't deep enough, and I use paper cups or baking paper if I have the time to snip it all up and make them look like bakery muffins. To be honest, it's a bit of a faff, Sometimes, if I don't have anything at all, I have just buttered the tin before pouring in the mixture. But I've found that it overcooks the edges, it makes them darker, and it actually makes them a little tough on the outside. So I would recommend paper cups. Once you have everything prepared, mix the dry ingredients until combined and mix the wet ingredients until combined. The reason that you're still keeping these separate is you want to do as little mixing as you can once the wet and the dry come into contact. Also, just a little tip, if you break the eggs and you get eggshell in with the egg mixture, the easiest way to get it out is by using the eggshell in your hand. You can just scoop it out. It's like a magnet. I don't know why it works, but it works. Now, make a well in the center of the dry ingredients and pour in the wet and then stir together. It's important not to overmix or you'll get tough, dry muffins. If you do this right, these muffins will be moist and fluffy and soft with a good rise and a good crispy golden brown top. I'm making myself hungry. Aim for up to 10 stirs and don't worry if you can see lumps of flour. Just be brave and spoon it into the paper cups anyway. Bake for 20 minutes and then check with a skewer inserted right down to the bottom of the muffin. You don't want a raw bottom. Before, I have ended up with soggy bottom muffins where I haven't pushed the skewer all the way down. They're still delicious, but you don't really want it. And anyway, you just leave them to cool. This recipe should make 10 to 12 muffins, depending on how generous you are with your scoops. I tend to just fill up the cups and then I will freeze usually about half the batch for a rainy day. For me, this comes in really handy just before I go to bed to grab a muffin out of the freezer and leave it to defrost overnight. And then I have muffins to just pop in the oven to heat through and crisp up in the morning. And it's a guaranteed breakfast that I know my toddler will eat. In late winter, when the weather is cold and it's wet and we are striving to get home and stay warm, it's easy to forget that we come from nature. We are a part of it. And especially this month, when it's about improvement and goal setting, I think it's also easy to forget that we have natural rhythms too. But for most of us, we live with expectations to always be functioning at our highest level, to look our best, feel our best, to have high energy, to be on top of everything. So many of us are trying to do our best at so many things, whether it's managing projects or people at work, parenting, relationships, school, university, or maybe a business. I think it's easy to forget that we have cycles. Our energy ebbs and it flows, whether it's daily, weekly, monthly, or yearly. Our drive, motivation, and enthusiasm, it comes and it goes. Some days will be high and others will be low. The moon waxes and wanes, tree sap rises and falls, flowers bloom and drop their petals, and trees shed their leaves. There is a rhythm to all things, and you just have to look outside to see it. Feeling connected to that really can help. And so for me, I will be swapping self-improvement with self-acceptance and self-compassion, which I think is a key to feeling better. Thank you for listening to this month's episode. If you'd like to hear more, then please press the follow button and you'll get a notification for each new episode release. And of course, feel free to rate and review. My muffin recipe can be found in the show notes, along with a link to my Instagram account. I'd like to say thank you to the lovely listeners that have taken the time to give me a rating and to leave me a review, and to those that have reached out on social media. It's truly lovely to hear from listeners. And I'm still so touched that there are listeners out there that tune in. I recently discovered that this podcast is now being downloaded in 10 countries across the world, and that was just thrilling. I am so excited. I love producing this podcast, and I can't wait to join you again in February for the next episode of Rooted by Nature.